Therefore, at that time, certain Chaldeans came forward and accused the Jews. They spoke and said to King Nebuchadnezzar, O king, live forever. You, O king, have made a decree that everyone who hears the sound of the horn, flute, harp, lyre, and psaltery, in symphony with all kinds of music, shall fall down and worship the gold image. And whoever does not fall down and worship shall be cast into the midst of a burning, fiery furnace. There are certain Jews whom you have set over the affairs of the province of Babylon, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. These men, O king, have not paid due regard to you. They do not serve your gods or worship the gold image which you have set up. Then Nebuchadnezzar, in rage and fury, gave the command to bring Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. So they brought these men before the king. Nebuchadnezzar spoke, saying to them, Is it true, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, that you do not serve my gods or worship the gold image which I have set up? Now, if you are ready at the time you hear the sound of the horn, flute, harp, lyre, and psaltery, in symphony with all kinds of music, and you fall down and worship the image which I have made, good. But if you do not worship, you shall be cast immediately into the midst of a burning fiery furnace. And who is the God who will deliver you from my hands? Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego answered and said to the king, O Nebuchadnezzar, we have no need to answer you in this matter. If that is the case, our God whom we serve is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace, and he will deliver us from your hand, O king. But if not, let it be known to you, O king, that we do not serve your gods, nor will we worship the gold image which you have set up. Then Nebuchadnezzar was full of fury, and the expression on his face changed towards Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. He spoke and commanded that they heat the furnace 7 times more than it was usually heated. And he commanded certain mighty men of valor who were in his army to bind Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego and cast them into the burning fiery furnace. Then these men were bound in their coats, their trousers, their turbans, and their other garments, and were cast into the midst of the burning fiery furnace. Therefore, because the king's command was urgent and the furnace exceedingly hot, the flame of the fire killed those men who took up Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And these 3 men, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, fell down bound into the midst of the burning fiery furnace. Amen. Why does anyone sin? Now, there are many answers to that question, and many important answers to that question. I just want to look at one answer as we begin this evening. Why does anyone sin? Well, one reason is this: because he is deceived. Nobody will ever sin unless he is deceived. When Jesus was speaking to the men who would push him to the cross, those religious leaders who hated him so much, he said this in John 8. You are of your father the devil, and the desires of your father you want to do. He was a murderer from the beginning and does not stand in the truth, because there is no truth in him. When he speaks a lie, he speaks from his own resources, for he is a liar and the father of lies. The devil is the father of sin, and lying is the father of sin. Do you remember back in Genesis chapter 3? What was the foundation of that sin? What was it that caused Eve to take of the fruit and to eat? It wasn't that she had sinful inclinations. She didn't. It wasn't that she had evil lusts. She didn't. The type of temptation that James describes in his letter where we are tempted from within because of our evil desires, that wasn't Eve's problem. She was perfect. What was it that produced the first sin? Not evil desire, but deceit. It was deceit. Eve was persuaded by the devil to believe his lie. He said to her, "Has God said?" Surely, in other words, God hasn't said that. Surely this tree, which is so luscious, fruit so appealing, so attractive, surely God would not say no. Surely God would not place such a gorgeous tree here in the middle of the garden and then say, "You can't have it." No, no. It cannot be that when you eat of it, you will die. That cannot be true. The truth is, when you eat of it, you will grow. You will understand more. You will receive more. You'll be like God. So eat, Eve. And she did. And the reason she ate was because she believed the lie. And like Eve, everybody who sins, sins because we believe the lie. No one would ever sin if he knew and lived by the truth. The truth about sin, of course, is that it is destructive. Sin destroys. The devil tempted Eve to take of the fruit and eat and persuaded her that it would do her good. But what did it do? The day you eat, you will die. She died. Her soul died. Her body began to die. It was the end for Eve. And that is what sin does. Sin destroys. And anybody who recognizes that destructive power of sin will turn away from it. Sin is like a time bomb. It sits in the corner of your life and it ticks and ticks and ticks. It seems harmless, just a piece of metal with a clock on it, ticking away. But one day it will detonate. And when it does, it will destroy. It will destroy you and it will destroy those around you and it will destroy anything and anyone with whom it comes into contact. That is sin. It is no respecter of persons. Sin destroys. The devil's aim all the time is to persuade people that sin does not destroy. And that is why one of the things the Bible constantly seeks to do is to paint in vivid colours the truth about sin. The true nature of sin. What is sin and what does it do? What are its consequences and what does it produce? The Bible, on virtually every page, reveals that reality to us and shakes us, as it were, by the lapels of our coat and says, "Wake up, this is sin." And Daniel 3 is no exception to that rule. In fact, one of the ways in which we can look at these verses we have read is in terms of a picture. The writer is painting in bright and vivid colours a picture of what sin is like. You think of the picture sitting there on the wall. That's Daniel 3. And underneath is the title of the picture. And it's two words. Sin destroys. What we're going to do this evening in our first look at these verses is just to describe that picture. To look at it. To analyse it. To see what sin is really like. The nature of the sin here revealed in these verses has many facets. It begins in verse 8. With these Chaldeans who came forward and accused the Jews. Our translation there really is rather pathetic. The literal word, I was amazed to find out, the Aramaic that's used here, it literally means he chewed them up into pieces. So we read, therefore at that time certain Chaldeans came forward and sought to chew the Jews to pieces. That's what they wanted to do. They wanted to get them in their teeth and chew them up. They wanted to destroy them. There's no question of that, obviously. Verse 11, whoever does not fall down and worship shall be cast into the midst of the burning fiery furnace. And oh, by the way, these three men whom you have appointed, verse 12, they are refusing to bow down. So what must be done? These men came then with what can only be described as a malicious accusation. They wanted to see these three men dead. And it was the envy of their hearts that stirred them up to that. These Jews, these three whippersnappers from from Jerusalem, appointed to senior positions in Jerusalem. We can't have this. In Babylon, sorry. We can't have this. They've got to be cut down. They've got to be destroyed. And so when they see their opportunity, they seize it. Sin seeks to destroy, you see. And the sin of the Chaldeans quickly leads, as they intend, to sin in Nebuchadnezzar, verse 13. It begins with rage and fury. Nebuchadnezzar is absolutely incensed that these three men, to whom he has shown such favour, whom he has welcomed into his court, whom he has appointed to senior positions, whom he has honoured before others, that these three men should dare to defy me, me, King Nebuchadnezzar, and refuse to bow down to my image. Cannot possibly have this. He is enraged, and his rage leads to proud threatenings, verses 14 and 15. Is it true? I can hardly believe it. Is it true? Tell me it isn't true, verse 14. Let's just end this all now. Of course you're bowing down to the image. Well, let's just make sure, shall we? Next time it plays, you will, of course, bow down, because if you don't, then I'll have that furnace made ready for you. And before you know it, you'll be in it. And who will deliver you out of my hands? Which God will save you out of my mighty hands? Here is Nebuchadnezzar now beginning to reach the height of his evil. Threatening these three men, abusing these three men, exercising his authority over them with a view to destroying them. And of course, when the three refuse to bow, when the three refuse to humble themselves under Nebuchadnezzar and worship his image, then Nebuchadnezzar, verse 19, was full of fury, and the expression on his face changed. I think this is a tremendous phrase here. Of course, verse 13, Nebuchadnezzar is already in rage and fury. So he's already enraged and furious. And yet verse 19, we're told that the expression on his face changed. Already enraged and furious, now he's even more enraged and furious. Already with a contorted and angry visage, now his face contorts even more. And their colour comes to his face, and I don't know, I'm trying to imagine what it must have been like. Perhaps he began to flail with his arms. Perhaps he stood up. Perhaps he shouted. Whatever it was, by the time we reach verse 19, Nebuchadnezzar has lost it completely. He's absolutely livid. He's so livid that he thinks to himself, these men aren't even afraid of my fiery furnace. Well, let us make the fiery furnace seven times hotter then, and see if they sniff at that. Of course, it's complete madness. A furnace is a furnace. You get thrown into the midst of a burning fiery furnace and you die. Whether it's twice as hot, three times as hot, or seven times as hot won't make a great deal of difference. You'll still be dead. But Nebuchadnezzar wasn't reasoning at this stage. He'd lost his reason. He was simply enraged. It's interesting to note that he commands that it should be seven times hotter, verse 19. Seven, of course, in Scripture, representing perfection. This furnace should have the quality of perfection of heat. Absolute heat. Ultimate heat. And you can imagine a fire that is burning to the ultimate perfection of heat. It is, of course, a picture of hell. These men are to be thrown into hell. And let us see them burn, says Nebuchadnezzar. And let us see who can save them out of my hands. So the whole thing ends with Nebuchadnezzar's murderous intent to destroy three men who have been faithful to him from the start. That is the sin. That is the picture. We've painted it in broad brushstrokes. What I want us to do now is look at it a little more detail and pick out three things in this picture. Three things about sin that we need to remember, that we need to allow to sink into our hearts, that we must understand. First, sin spreads like a disease. Sin spreads like a disease. I'm sure you've noticed that the dreaded pox has been doing the rounds in the church recently, hopping from one child to the next. And chicken pox really is a remarkable illustration of how sin works, how it spreads. Benedict was sick for a couple of days over the weekend. We knew that chicken pox was around. We knew that he was probably going to come down with it. But when the first spot appears, you think to yourself, oh, you know, it's not too severe. It'll be all right. But it's remarkable how from one spot to the whole body absolutely covered in the things is a very, very short period of time, perhaps even only 24 hours, 36 hours. And that's how sin works and spreads within a person. Once you've got one spot, it never stays at one. In no time at all, your whole being is covered. It's infected, every part, because it's in the blood, you see, and it goes through the whole body. But then this wretched thing doesn't even stay with one person as that person comes into contact with other people. So it passes from one to the next. And just as Benedict recovers, then John Mark goes down with it. And now he's covered with these things. It's just how sin is. It starts so small. It spreads through a person. And then it spreads through another and through another and through another. Sin is like that. It spreads like a disease. Notice how sin spreads in this story. It spreads within Nebuchadnezzar, doesn't it? We noted it. Verse 13, he begins with anger. He moves to pride and to threatening. Then he moves, verse 19, to even more fury. He moves into this uncontrolled rage. And that leads to wild, mad, murderous intent. The desire to destroy, the passion to crush. Just as it was with the chicken pox, so with Nebuchadnezzar, one spot always leads to another and to another until the whole person is consumed by this sin. Notice also how in this story it isn't Nebuchadnezzar who begins the whole thing off, it's these Chaldeans. They are the ones who have the pox in the first place, as it were, with their envy and their pride and their bitterness of heart. But it's interesting, the Chaldeans knew that Nebuchadnezzar would catch the disease just like that. All they had to do was go in his presence and breathe on him. And he would be infected, and that's exactly how it was, isn't it? They went in, just spoke a few choice words, carefully chosen, and bang, Nebuchadnezzar's off. From the first spot to a total infection in no time at all. That's what sin is like. It spreads like a disease. Second notice here. Sin penetrates like a knife. I'm sure you've all seen at some time one of those old films with knives and swords and what have you. And the knives that they used to use in battle, knives so long, obviously made out of very, very, very sharp metal, sharpened to an extremely fine point. And yet, up those two edges of the knife, such sharpness that once that knife pierces the skin, once it goes through the outer coating of a person's body, there is nothing stopping it penetrating right the way through. Straight through to the heart. And that's just what sin is like. Once sin has penetrated through a person's outer being, there is nothing stopping it getting right to the core and the center of that person. No human person can escape the power of sin. It pierces, it cuts, it divides, and it does so without respect. It is so sharp that, like that knife, it's humanly unstoppable. You can't prevent it penetrating right the way through. That's how it was for Nebuchadnezzar, wasn't it? He was a man of power. He was a man of authority. He was a man in control. He knew what it was to order and to dominate. And yet here in this chapter, we see that he did not have control over himself. He could control others, order others, control empires and kingdoms and armies, but he couldn't control himself. We've seen him here behaving like an animal, losing control completely. What is happening? Sin. Once it penetrates, it goes right the way through to the heart. Nebuchadnezzar began the chapter with what he thought was a wonderful plan and scheme for international unity. Let us build this image and get everybody to focus upon the image and worship the image, and everybody will be united. But what began with at least some veneer of honourability, yet it had sin at its heart, as we've already seen. It ended up in this dreadful rage and fury, and the furnace heated seven times hotter. Verse 19, you see, that's what sin is like. It penetrates. Like a knife, it goes right the way through. And then thirdly, as we look at this picture of sin, we notice that sin devastates. Like that bomb we spoke of earlier on. Sin devastates like a bomb. That's what's so distressing, isn't it, about these suicide bombers that we read and hear and see so much of today in our world. The most awful thing about those bombs is that they're indiscriminate, aren't they? It's always distressing to see human death and hatred of man against man. But when it's indiscriminate, when it doesn't discriminate or divide between the guilty and the innocent, then there is something particularly horrible about it. When that suicide bomber goes into the town centre and detonates off his bomb, he doesn't just blow up the police and the army men and the politicians that it's directed at. There's also a pregnant mother walking down the street and she's blown to smithereens. There's a baby in a pram and she's blown away. It's horrible, isn't it? The power of that detonation. And that is what sin is like. Sin destroys everything and everyone. It infects and it penetrates and it ruins everything that it touches. I want you to imagine for a moment that in this story, God does not intervene. Of course, he does intervene. We're going to come to that. And thank God he intervenes. But just for this picture of sin, imagine this story running its course without God at all. What would be the outcome? What would sin produce? Well, for the three faithful servants, Shadrach, Meshach and Abednego, an early, untimely, utterly unjust death. For the obedient soldiers and officials who carry the three men to suffer their so-called judgment, an early and untimely death in the course of duty. For the malicious Chaldeans, what does sin do to them? It makes them murderers. It makes them hateful men whose hearts are full of bitterness and evil and darkness. And what about this king? Makes this king like an animal. It makes him nothing more than a Spanish bull in the bullfighting ring, just having the red rag dangled under his nose, and he's off. That's what sin does. It destroys people from within, it works its way out, and ultimately it ruins them completely. That's what sin does. Like that bomb, it leaves carnage and destruction wherever it penetrates and wherever it spreads. It's a horrible picture. And just as sin was in Nebuchadnezzar's day, so sin is today. That's the thing about the scripture. The Bible is set in a particular period and particular time. But all that it teaches us about mankind is timeless. It is always true. Isn't it true that sin spreads like a disease? Isn't it true? Every single person likes to believe that sin isn't like that. But it is. It never sticks at one spot. It always spreads. Just look at some examples. Visit 6-year-old Johnny. And 6-year-old Johnny, he tells a white lie to get his friend out of trouble. Of course, it's well-intentioned. And he didn't want his pal to get a spanking for that disobedience or for that defiance. And so he tells a lie to cover up for him. But we revisit little Johnny 20 years on. He's 26 years old now. And what do we find? We find that he is a man with no integrity. We find that he is a man who has forgotten the difference between truth and error. We find he is a man who in his conversation exaggerates everything to such a degree that not even he knows what the truth is. We find that he is a man who just doesn't care about the truth. He believes that just by saying something he can make it true. Or what about a young girl? And we visit her at age 11. She's been accused of something which is completely exaggerated. Oh yes, all right, I did do it, but it wasn't that way, and it wasn't as bad as you're saying it was. And all her desire to defend herself comes out, and like that porcupine, she shoots out all her spines and thrusts everybody off. And you're not allowed to accuse me like that. She defends herself. She justifies herself. She stands on her own two feet. We say that's harmless enough, isn't it? But revisit this same girl 20 years later. She's 31 now. She's still in the church. She still believes the Bible. And she still professes to be a Christian. But this young woman is full of nothing other than Pharisaic pride. For that desire to defend herself that was latent there when she was 11 has now flourished and mushroomed and developed into perfect Pharisaism. She's an expert on everybody else's sins. She knows all about everyone else, what they do wrong, how they behave, how they act, where they've got their doctrine wrong and their understanding wrong, where their behaviour's out of line. She knows all about it. And whenever she's accused, of course, she's always clean. She's never guilty. And when the preacher speaks on sin, she always walks away with the slate wiped clean. What about that young man? He's 21 years old and recently married. And he's happy with his young wife. But he just glances. He just glances at that young woman who walks across the road each day on her way back to her own house. And after a few weeks, the glance becomes a little bit more than a glance. And then it becomes a protracted stare. And as the years go by, and this same girl continues in this same pattern of living, and his wife, she has children, and she finds things tough, and she puts on a bit of weight, and you know, she doesn't take quite such care with her hair. She doesn't have an hour and a half every morning anymore. She has to be up looking after the children, doing the work in the home, sweating and labouring over the practical duties. But this girl doesn't have to do any of that. She still has all that time. She still looks just right. You revisit this man when he's 36 and he's in that woman's bed. And it all started with a glance. That's all it was, just a glance. We could go on with the list. It starts with a thought. She just feels that little bit angry with him. That he's not listening or understanding or taking time. But it ends up with bitterness of heart and rage and anger and animosity. It starts with patriotism. I love my country. I love the way things are. But it ends up with racist abuse and fear of other people's. And we could go on with the list. That's what sin is like. Never just one spot. It always spreads. It always infects. And then it moves from person to person. That's how whole societies and communities become infected with sin. And in our society today, it is not only through personal contact that this sin spreads from person to person. The devil, in his genius, has set up a system of communication that is called the media. Films, music, advertisements, television, whatever. And through all of these channels, sin spreads. It's noxious spores, like so much chemical nightmare, sent into people's homes and into people's lives, infusing all their thoughts and attitudes and outlooks with godless and wicked ways. That sin, it spreads. It's horrible. And then it penetrates, doesn't it? It penetrates like that knife. Everybody likes to think that sin can be hemmed in. I can just have one sin. I can keep it under control. How many people have done that? They've embraced the sin in their lives and they've really persuaded themselves. I can just have this one sin. I'll turn away from all others. Nobody needs to, doesn't need to harm anybody. It's rather like somebody just embracing one knife. Won't do any harm, just one knife. If I take this one knife and just bring it into my bosom, it won't do me any harm, will it? Try it. See if you survive. Sin is never under control. Sin always penetrates. Just like Nebuchadnezzar, it takes the person to places you never intended to go. Adam and Eve never intended to die. Adam and Eve never intended to defy God. They never set out to sin. But look what it did to them. It's the same with all of us. Who can stop the white lie producing a total lack of integrity? Who can stop that instinct for self-defense producing Pharisaic pride? Who can? Who can stop the glance leading to adultery? Who can stop the thoughts leading to rage? Who can prevent these things? Once the knife of sin has pierced the surface, it goes right the way through and there's no stopping it. And then sin devastates, doesn't it? Like that dreadful bomb, it devastates. It leaves carnage. Oh, the carnage that it had the potential to produce here in Daniel 3 without the intervention of God. It's that carnage that we see in our society, isn't it? Our society is full of people who do not even know what the truth is. No, we can go further than that, can't we? Our society is full of people who do not even want to know what the truth is. In fact, we have decided today that the truth is our enemy. And in the name of something called tolerance, we have decided that truth should be thrown away completely. And each person should have their own set of beliefs, which are equally valid. And whatever the truth is, it doesn't matter. That's just for arrogant people. Isn't that an absolute masterstroke of the devil? What a deception to persuade people that the truth is your enemy. And that's what he succeeded in doing today. We have a society full of people who are expert in defending themselves. Why is it that it is harder than ever today to penetrate anybody's heart with an awareness of sin? Why is it that when you talk about a saviour with people today, they simply do not know what you are talking about? What do I need to be saved from? Sorry, I missed that bit. I'm sure everything's just fine. You challenge somebody, their immediate response is, well, I'm a good person. I'm a good person. What have they done? They've become experts in defending themselves. In putting up that barrier around themselves. In making themselves feel good. We've mentioned before, what is the favourite topic of conversation in the office or on the shop floor? It's his sins, her failings, his inadequacies, their stupidity. All those people out there, why they are wrong. And of course, why I am right. That's sin. It devastates, it destroys. We spoke of a glance earlier on. Men today do not just glance at women. Not even the best of men do not just glance at women. No, men today, almost to a man, excuse themselves from fixing their gaze upon a woman other than their own wife. And isn't it strange that in this kind of inverted, weird society we live in, that women have bought into it? So those young women in their late teens and 20s actually go around wearing deliberately provocative clothing? Do you know the only people who are made sick by that young, unmarried woman who dresses in a provocative way and shows off parts of her body to whoever may care to stare? The only people who are made sick by that are those married women in their 30s and 40s who are working and building and laboring for their husbands, and they know their husbands have got their eyes on another woman. That's the sort of situation we're in today. Only yesterday, a friend came to see me and told me that his whole life, in his own terminology, his whole life has just been destroyed by adultery, by unfaithfulness. That's what sin does. It destroys, it devastates, and it's indiscriminate. It doesn't care, men, women, children, good, bad, whoever. What kind of people do we become? What kind of society do we produce? What kind of carnage does sin lead to? Well, that's the picture. What can we say in conclusion? Well, first, let us call sin by its real name. Destruction. That's what sin is. Sin always destroys. And we must remove from sin anything that we attach to it that makes it seem less than it is. You cannot have a white sin, or an innocent sin, or a harmless sin, or a benign sin, or a small sin, or a sin that's just a bit of fun. Just imagine a doctor examining his patient, and he looks at the MRI scan and has the patient in and sits the patient down and smiles broadly and says to the patient, "Well, there's nothing to worry about here. You've got a cancerous tumour, but don't worry, it's a white one. It's an innocent one. It's a harmless one. It's a small one. Oh, it's only having a little bit of fun inside you there." A cancerous tumour is a cancerous tumour, however small it is. However white it is, however harmless it is, whatever phrase you want to attach to it, it'll kill you. It'll destroy you. One sin destroys a soul. That's why there is a hell. That's why there is a place that is heated 7 times hotter. And the soul that sins will die and be cast into that pit. There is an application here for those of us who are bringing up children. When our children sin, it's not harmless. It's not just their personality working its way out. It's not just a bit of fun. Sin is sin. Let us call it by its name, and that sin will destroy whomever it infects. Call sin by its real name. Second, confess your powerlessness to resist sin. Sin spreads, sin penetrates, sin destroys. And the truth is that there is nothing that you or I or any man can do to prevent it. One of the biggest errors that has afflicted Christianity over the centuries is the teaching that the Bible gives us a good model to follow. That the Bible encourages us to be good people. Morality, in other words. But that is not the message of the Bible. That is the opposite to the message of the Bible. That's the message of the world. The message of the Bible is, it doesn't matter how hard you try, and it doesn't matter what you do, you cannot change yourself. You cannot save yourself. You cannot fight this sin. You will never stop lying. You will never stop defending yourself and putting others down. You will never stop yourself glancing at that woman. You will never stop thinking those sinful thoughts. You will never stop fearing people of other cultures. It'll never happen. You're a sinner. You cannot change yourself. What must you do? The Bible is so clear. You must confess it to God. Fall down upon your knees before God and tell him the truth. This is the first truth that any man must confess before God if he is ever to be saved. We must confess before him the truth of our sin and our inability to do anything about it. That's where we start. And even as Christian people, that's where we start every day. Lord, I am a sinner. And however hard I try today, I cannot overcome my sin. Forgive me. And dear God, give me strength. And that brings us to our third and final point. What must we do? We must seek the only one who can save us. The glorious thing about Daniel 3 is that sin does not get the victory. And there is only one reason why. Because God intervenes. And without that intervention of God, sin will finish its evil work and will destroy everyone. But God does intervene. He intervenes through Shadrach, Meshach and Abednego, his three men. And they say, verse 17, our God whom we serve is able to deliver us, and he will deliver us. That's our God. He will deliver us from your hand, O King. You have no power over us at all. We are free from the power of sin. And your power over us is no power. We're in God's hands. He will save us. And so we read verse 24. King Nebuchadnezzar was astonished. And he rose in haste and spoke, saying to his counselors, did we not cast three men bound into the midst of the fire? They answered and said to the king, true, O king. Look, he answered, I see four men loose, walking in the midst of the fire, and they are not hurt, and the form of the fourth is like the Son of God. Thank God he intervened. Thank God sin did not win the day. Thank God that he and he alone is able to stop sin spreading, to stop sin penetrating, to stop sin destroying. This is the magnificent message of the gospel. That God has intervened in our lives. God has intervened in our world. And God has changed everything. And the Lord Jesus Christ came into this world. He proved that he had power over sin. He lived a sinless life, didn't he? No matter how many times the devil came at him and, as it were, breathed over Christ, day after day, hour over hour, from the outside, the infection of sin, the evil of sin, the wickedness of sin, and sought to infect Christ with that, not one of those noxious spores ever entered Christ's spiritual system. He was free from it all. It didn't matter how many times the devil came at him with that knife of sin. So sharp, so finely pointed. Never did the devil craft temptations more carefully and more powerfully than he did when he attacked Christ. And he came at him, he stabbed at him, and he stabbed at him, but he never penetrated. The devil knew he only needed to draw one drop of blood to pierce the spiritual skin of Christ. And he knew that the knife would go all the way. Just one sin, that's all it needed. Just one thought. Just one glance. Just one idea. Just one word, that's all he needed. The devil knew, just one pinprick. And I've got him. And no matter how he tried, he never succeeded. A totally sinless life. How many times did the devil seek to destroy Christ with the power of sin? And never once. Not ever once. And then, having lived this sinless life, completely free from sin's disease, from sin's penetration, from sin's destruction, he then hangs upon that cross. He then dies. He is then thrust into that fire seven times hotter. What is he doing there? Why is he in the fire? He's in the fire in the place of his people. He's taking the punishment for sin. He's enduring the consequences of sin, all the sin of all his people. And then on the third day, he rose again. And there was not the smell of any fire upon his being. He had conquered. He had defeated sin once and for all. And now he is able. Jesus Christ seated upon the throne this very evening. He is able. He is able to free you now from the pollution of sin and from the power of sin. He's able to cleanse you completely from all of those noxious spots. And he's able to free you from the power of sin. He is able to strengthen you so that the knife of sin need not penetrate and destroy. But most wonderful of all, yes, we have freedom now from sin's pollution and sin's power. But the day is coming when he will return. And on that day, we will have freedom from sin's very presence. Sin will be banished. And in the new heaven and in the new earth, there will be no picture with the writing underneath, "Sin destroys." For every such picture will have been cast into the pit where it belongs. And there will be life and light and everlasting joy. May God help us to come to Christ and find in him freedom. Amen.